In December 1973, shortly before his death, Ernest Becker talked with Psychology Today editor Sam Keen. They talked about power, isolation, the absurdity of life, and death. That interview formed the basis of a conversation published in the April issue of Psychology Today. This cassette is an edited version of the original interview tapes. Because the interview took place in Becker's hospital room, the sound quality is often poor. We hope, however, that the present tape gives much of the flavor of that meeting.
Would you like to tell me something about how you came to be who you are, and something of the story of...
Well...
How did you get into this business to begin with, and...
How did I get into the intellectual business?
Well, yeah, the whole thing. How'd you come to the position that you occupy?
Well, I don't know. I think in the sense in which every young man is a searcher, trying to find out what his talent is and what he's good at, and hoping that he gets a chance to prove his excellence and prove that he can be heroic. I think in that sense I was a searcher. Feeling that I had something special to give, which every young man has, and hoping that I could translate this specialness into some kind of external form. And I went through the war, World War II, and back to civilian life, into the university, and I don't know, I guess I just became, I don't really know what to say. I just sort of stumbled along like everybody else, trying to understand things. I was always very interested in what makes people act the way they do. This has been one of my principal obsessions, you might say. I was always very interested in why people act the way they do. I never gave this problem up. I always kept coming back to it. It intrigued me. And when I was in graduate school, I went to graduate school, like everybody else does, to get a meal ticket. It was nothing terribly idealistic. There was no idealism in my motives for going back to college. I was in my early 30s and I was floundering. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'd lived in New York for a number of years. I lived in Paris for 5 years. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And I started to become frightened that I hadn't realized this inner talent, this gift that the adolescent feels he has. And I was in my early 30s, and I got scared. And then I thought, well, where was I happy? Where was I well off? Where did I seem to be doing something that made me valuable? And I remembered that I'd been particularly good in college. And it was kind of a happy life. So I really chose it as kind of a meal ticket. I said, okay, I'll be a teacher. And I went back with that in mind. And it was a pretty cut and dried thing, working for the meal ticket. And I found that I liked it very much more than I thought I would like it. And I think the real question to be asked is about me that is distinctive after this, is how I became interdisciplinary. I mean, why I range so broadly, why I'm not a specialist, why I'm a generalist. I think this is the question that has to be answered. The rest of it is pretty cut and dried about a young man trying to express his specialness and trying to find a way to earn bread by that. The question that has to be asked is why I didn't bog down into some particular discipline. I think the answer to that is that I was just lucky. I was in graduate school and I was working on Zen Buddhism. As a matter of fact, I became interested in Zen. And in order to do the kind of dissertation that I wanted, I had to go out of the historical treatment of Zen into a psychological treatment. and which meant that I had to go into, I had to study psychoanalysis. And so I picked up Fennekel's big encyclopedic work on outlines of psychoanalysis. And I started reading that. And this was, I think, the thing that broke me out of the boundaries of anthropology. And I became very fascinated with psychoanalysis and very dissatisfied at the same time. And I had the good fortune at that time to get a job at the Upstate Medical Center where Tom Zaz was working. So I became his colleague for a while, and his kind of iconoclasm and daring and self-criticism of his own field gave those around him also the feeling they had the mandate to be critical too. So I felt I could be critical of psychoanalysis at the same time as appreciative of it. And at that point the die was cast. I became a multidisciplinary thinker and focused on the question of why people act the way they do, and became interested, of course, always interested in philosophy, and then I discovered Tillich, which was a big moment for me. I remember picking up, going into a bookstore, and looking at the book Systematic Theology, Volume 3, and reaching for it and saying, well, what do I have to learn from theology? My hand felt back, and I said, I don't know, maybe there's something. And I took the book out and I cracked it open. I said, gee, this looks good. And I bought it, and it was a big moment for me.
Volume 3.
Volume 3.
Yeah, I mean, that's the liveliest of the volumes.
Yeah,
there.
I started with Volume 3. And I discovered that these people were really trying to answer the same questions we were. What makes people act the way they do? And what does it mean to be a man? And so then everything sort of fell into my purview at that point. And I had a long, a very anachronistic struggle with Freud, where I tried to, without realizing that his instinct theory had been disproven a generation ago, I worked on disproving it. I think many people went through that. And I think that's what has to explain my interdisciplinariness. And so I just, for several years, read everything I could get my hands on. And I have the kind of mind that tries to impose a pattern on what I work on. I try to unify it and simplify it and economize it. In that sense, I like to think that I have a certain simple-mindedness. I don't like complexity. And I try to impose simple-minded patterns on the manifold of experience. And I think this is a necessity for a synthetic thinker. And I think I've been successful in that. I feel like I've been able, with a certain amount of simple-mindedness, to take large, difficult issues and boil them down to essentials. And I think this is my particular strength. I can't stand mystery and esoterics. And I want everything to be clear and discursive. This is why I don't like the later Norman O'Brien. I just don't understand that kind of thing. I don't know what it means. I don't know what purpose it serves. I know that poetry and myth are important, ultimately the most important thing. But as a scientist and as a thinker, I think one has to remain on a discursive level. Yes.
Well, something that certainly a lot of people would ask is that. Is it accidental that you became fascinated with the topic of death? Is this a premonition for you? And was this a life task which was suddenly handed to you?
I see what you mean, yeah. You know, a few people have asked me whether, I became ill with cancer last year. And my book, Denial of Death, was published this year. and they said, was there something, they were looking for something ontological, maybe this had worked into my awareness somehow that I had occupied myself with this problem. No, it has nothing to do with myself. It's purely, that book was written long before I, was finished long before, a full year before I was sick, in its initial forms. I came upon the idea of denial of death strictly from the logical imperatives of all my other work. I discovered that, in fact, this was the idea that tied the whole thing. This was the ultimate economical simplification. This was the ultimate, idea that everything reduced itself to. And I found this in the work of Otto Rank. When I found Rank, I got terribly excited. I don't think anyone has excited me as much as Rank, whom I consider to be one of the most terribly neglected thinkers of modern times, a man of genius, really, who worked this thing through very systematically in many ways, showing that the fear of life and the fear of death are the mainsprings of human activity, and that everything can be explained from that, from those fears. And he did this in a most beautiful way, historically and psychologically both. His historical psychology has yet to be used and discovered, although Lifton is working on a similar tack with variations.
It seems to me that there is, that you have done something which is extremely valuable to bring this together, and is really incredibly neglected, this aspect, the tragic aspect of life. But it also seems to me, too, that there's a certain distortion in it, that when I look at your work, I think immediately of Rudolf Otto, and if you look at life in the raw, it is a mysterium, and it's tremendum. But Otto says two things, that the mysterium is tremendum et fascinans, and it seems to me that you pick the tremendum aspect and you deal with life as awesome and as terrifying and as you speak a great deal of the terror of life, and that life in its holiness is terrible, and in Hindu thought the god Kali always has blood dripping from her mouth, but it's also fascinans. And the fascinans aspect is the degree to which we are drawn by something which is desirable, and which is, so it seems to me that there's a kind of dual, at the basic ontological level, there's a kind of duality of motivation, and only part of it is terror and fear of death, part of it is that which just draws us, the eros which draws us into life, and which is unconnected with the aspect of terror, like sexuality itself, which has all of the terror and yet always has the terror, and yet it also has the fantastic appeal.
Yeah. Well, all right. I have no argument. I think that's very well put. I have no argument with that, except only to say that when one is doing a work, one is always in some way directing that work against prevailing trends. In other words, the work itself has a certain iconoclastic meaning too. And if I stress the terror, it's only because I'm talking to the cheerful robots, as C. Wright Mills would say. And I just think the world is full of too many cheerful robots. And I consider it my task, in fact, to talk about the terror. Rather than everyone's talking about the joy, and everyone's talking about the good things, and I just feel that in that sense the critical intellectual has to call attention to what is lacking, and I suppose that gives him a one-sidedness. I remember this time I lectured to this group of theologians, remember, at Union Seminary here. And I was talking about pretty much what we're talking about, the dynamic of evil, man's fault, man's creatureliness. You should think, in talking to a bunch of theologians, I would have been communicating with them, right? They were up in arms. They were, one of the guys said, "Man, he wanted to throw me out the window." He said, "How can you talk against the world out there, that and beautiful world in which we've achieved so much, how can you make that seem as though it were merely a reflex of your own kind of morbid sense feelings about life and so on? And it seems to me that theologians themselves have gotten away from what the world is all about. And I was really shocked. I was really quite shocked that the theologians would turn. I would expect businessmen to turn on me. In trying to explain human evil, in the book I'm working on now, I want to try to pull together, see if I have any talent that's pulling together, right, what other people have already said, in effect. Well, there is already exists in the libraries a completely comprehensive theory of what the phenomenon of Nazism is all about. That, explaining that evil, that sadism. But it hasn't been pulled together. What I wanted to do is pull it together between two covers to explain from all possible sides why we use scapegoats, why we try to find, why each person needs a Jew or a nigger, somebody to kick. We all need somebody to kick, somebody to give us a feeling of specialness, special purity. And I've been working on the phenomenon I'm working on the Holocaust. And when you're working on the Holocaust, it does something to you. It gives you a certain realism about life. The kind of things that happened during the Holocaust, which people don't really know yet. The reports that came out of Nuremberg and the kind of things that were done in these death camps are so atrocious, so terrifying, that it's no longer possible, and this is of course something the Jews themselves realize, it's no longer possible to have a naturally optimistic view of the world. And we're obviously, that one of the reasons that we're on this planet is to be slaughtered, which of course is the Christian message. We are here to be slaughtered. And this comes home so strongly. It comes home so full in the face.
Well, isn't the message more that if we do not allow ourselves to be used up, then we will be slaughtered?
Well, in any event, we're slaughtered, right? We're used up on one hand, like Chekhov's peasants or Gorky's peasants. You can see the brutal life, the brutal unthinking life of vodka and wife beating and bickerings. We're either used up in that way, or, as you say, we're used up, we're just outright slaughtered. And I don't think it's a matter of F or, I think it's a matter of both. I mean, we're both slaughtered, and I have a friend who was a psychologist and of tragic leanings. And she gets up every morning and says, today the blow is going to fall. Which is the Jewish consciousness again. Is it today that the blow is going to fall?
Which is also a way of warding it off, of course.
Yeah, it's also a way of getting ready for it,
yeah.
warding off the effects of it by expecting it. But the facility with which objects disappear, the suddenness with which tragedy happens. Again, I mentioned Chekhov because I happen to be reading Chekhov's stories. I mentioned whatever is current in my mind. I just read about 10 volumes of Chekhov's stories. And there's this marvelous story about a guy who's a peasant who's taking his wife to a doctor. She's very ill. And he's on a sleigh. And he's taking her to the doctor through a snowstorm. And he's talking to her. He's, don't worry, dear, we'll get there soon. And he starts reminiscing about the kind of life they've had together. He realizes she's been a good woman. He's never really even thought about their life and so on. And maybe she should have been a little nicer to her now that they're getting old and so on. And he looks back and knows the snowflakes aren't melting on her face. And just when he developed this great sentimental mood toward her, she's dead. And he said, oh my God, how sudden everything happened. And he turns the sleigh around and drives the snowstorm. Finally, he gets despondent and he falls asleep. And then he wakes up in a room and he says, doctor, what happened to my arms and legs? Arms and legs were amputated. The doctor said, you fool, you allowed yourself to freeze. I says, my God, how sudden. How suddenly all happens. And I think this is a beautiful insight into the suddenness of catastrophe. And the thing that people try to banish most from their minds with their character on, which is the suddenness with which terror strikes life on the planet. The fact that people are really so fragile, so insecure. There's nothing they can do. That's a beautiful line from a pawnbroker where he repeats, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't do anything. There's nothing he could do. And this idea that there's nothing you can do is not something that people allow themselves to bring to consciousness. They always feel there's something they can do. So they manufacture these huge edifices of control. And the Russians imagine they're doing something in the world. In fact, the Russian denial of accident is very interesting, of accidentality and suddenness and contingency. They don't publish airplane crash announcements in their own country. See, in paradise, these things are supposed to have been eliminated. So the only time you hear about a Soviet air crash is when it's smuggled out from foreign news sources. And this is a state dedicated to the hyper-control of accident. And having no God to explain anything anymore, they've got to do all the explaining. So they have to control accident.
It just struck me as anomalous that the Christian Science papers call Christian Science Monitor.
Yeah.
Because it monitors out.
Yeah.
It monitors out catastrophes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is the control aspect of character on it, which is so vital to the human being. I mean, I don't know what people would do at large if they had to live with this knowledge that there's nothing they can do and that accident and catastrophe are imminent. It's really quite impossible to live that way. Worried about every car that goes by and when your kid is going to school. You just can't live this way. And yet, actually, this is the way things happen, isn't it? The planet runs this way. So the human life, the sort of the natural craziness of human life, the fact that people are, in effect, daily, lead crazy daily lives, is a result of the craziness of their position. I bring this out, I think, in the denial of death, and in the second edition of the Birth and Death of Meaning, how natural it is for man to be a crazy animal because of the crazy life that he had, because of his knowledge of death. I'm growing increasingly suspicious of all idealisms and all hopefulnesses. I don't know what this means. I'm not saying I'm right. Mind you, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not saying I'm with it. I may be wrong, and the currents may be going by me. But I'm very suspicious of all these things. And people who talk about these hopefulnesses and talk about the togethernesses and talk about possibilities, I'm just very suspicious of all these things. I think works like Endgame and Zomner's Planet and the tenant. I think these are the true works of our time. The terrible, hopeless isolation of people from one another. Kafka. To me, it seems like grabbing at straws to talk about left brain, right brain. Types of relationships that were overlooking the radiating influences and hopelessness. I'm not comfortable there anymore.
Well, your own option in life for yourself is a Stoic form of heroism.
Yeah, a Stoic with the qualification that I believe in. I believe in God. Stoic until it's.
But that in order to come to that point of trust, that all illusions must be broken.
Yeah, that's an issue. In fact, all illusions must be broken. But the thing that is killing, it's programmatic, right? From a critical scientific point of view. I feel if you're going to be a critical scientist in these times, then all illusions must be broken. But the fundamental scientific task now, even though it means a certain warp and bias,
on the part of the scientist, even though you're getting at something, let's say you're getting at something valid in terms of a criticism of me. I'm not saying you are, I don't know. But it seems to me that the fundamental scientific critical task is the utter elimination of any consolations that are not empirically based. That is a complete stark picture of what the human condition is without any consolations. And this seems to me to be the task and the need. And as I said, I bend over a little backwards to give this, but it seems to me just wholly necessary now. And that to offer little ways out and little ways around attenuates the force of this necessary.
Well, in the moment when you say, yes, I'm a Stoic, but of course I believe in God, and the moment when your mind flips into that space, what does the world look like? How do you see yourself now? I mean, looking at yourself with those dual perspectives, what do you see and feel?
Well, I feel... I suppose the most immediate thing I feel is relieved of the burden of responsibility for my own life, putting it back where it belongs, on whoever or whatever hatched me. I think this is the most immediate thing I feel, which is a great sense of relief and trust that eggs are not hatched in vain. Mm-hmm. Heschel's idea beyond the state of the universe, God. And it was beyond this miasma of accident and contingency and terror and death. There's a meaning that redeems it. This is why it redeems it, not necessarily in any personal way of immortality or anything like that, but that makes it good somehow, and that this is enough. This is what I mean. And I think when you talk in the terms in which you're talking about a personal achievement in that realm, in that feeling realm. Now, I would not want to disparage this. I just think that, and on the one hand, you're talking about my published intellectual work, which was on the level of house cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you're talking about Lao Tzu and something like that, which I think is already beyond the level of intellectual house cleaning. And has, of course, a great and even a higher validity. But for people to talk about joy and happiness and to be dancing around completely under the aegis of their Oedipus complex without any self-knowledge at all, completely reflexive, driven creatures, this doesn't somehow seem honest to me. Something, I don't know, the thing that I really can't understand, I always watch Billy Graham when he's on, because I can't understand that guy. I can't understand that kind of reflexive joy. There's something very spooky about it. The whole evangelical fundamentalist movement. I just can't understand how they can be so sure and how they can be so secure in their happiness. The thing has all the characteristics to me of a straight conditioning phenomenon. Skinner's box.
Yeah.
And at that level, I don't like to talk about states of joy. But the level of which you play, of course, I would want to see him talking about as a higher human achievement, where the life is left behind and where emotional and other types of experience start coming into play.
You know, I come back to present situations an awful lot in my thinking and everything. And I realize that one of the things about even being here and talking to you, one of the problems is that it exemplifies what you're talking about. That my tendency, of course, is to avoid death. And even to speak to you as if I were in a different category, as if because you were dying and I wasn't, somehow, you know, we were different categories.
Yeah.
And I realize, you know, that's really stupid, and that to talk to you, I need to talk to you really as someone who's not one bit different than you are.
Yeah.
And so to ask some questions that I really want to ask you personally, like you have thought harder and more about death in this book than most anybody in the modern world, and now you're, as it were, doing your empirical research. And,
it always hurts when I laugh.
And somehow, you know, I'd like to ask you what you can add as a person going through this, you know, to speak to people, because it's so hard dying in our culture. And I think that just as a person, you must have a lot that could be added alongside of what you have said, you know, when you were not so close to the experience.
I see what you mean, I don't know, I really can't say anything that anyone else hasn't already said about dying or death. You know, there's been some very beautiful research done on it by Avery Wiseman at Harvard. He's occupied with this, and I don't think I've thought about it longer and harder than people like himself or Kastenbaum or Kubler-Ross or those people, you know. I think they've been working with patients who were dying and so on. Kubler-Ross. I don't really have anything to add except to say that, you know, to repeat what others have already said, and that is that, there's really nothing new. And that is that what makes it easier is to be able to transcend the world into some kind of religious dimension. And that's the most important thing. To know that beyond the absurdity of one's life, beyond the apparent injustice of things, beyond the human viewpoint, beyond what's happening to us, there is the fact of the tremendous creative energies of the cosmos, which are using us for some purposes we don't know. And to be used for purposes, for divine purposes, however we may be misused. I think of Luther, when he says, Lord, thou bruisest me, but since it is you, it's all right. So something to that effect. And this is the thing I think that consoles, or Peggy, who, when his child had this very serious illness, he just went to church and gave the child over to God and said, I can't do anything, you take care of it. And I think this is the beauty of it. I think one does that with one's life too, or should try to just hand it over. The meaning of it, the value of it, the end of it, whatever it may mean. This has been most important to me. I think it's very hard for secular men to die, yeah. I think it's very hard for secular men to die. The injustice of it, as it seems to him. The meaning of the point is...
Has this become more tangible to you when you became ill? And in what way did your religious tradition, have you found yourself going back to the symbols of, you came out of what, a Jewish tradition?
Yeah, I came out of a Jewish tradition, but I was an atheist for many years. And I only rewoke to the dimension of the divine gradually through, what was that beautiful saying? It's not the intellect that teaches us about God, it's life that teaches us about God. And through seeing children born, and just sort of waking up to the miracle of what's going on. I think this is what woke me up. I think the birth of my first child was the miracle that woke me up to the idea of God more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Seeing something pop in from the void, and seeing how magnificent it was, and how unexpected, and and how much beyond our powers and our kin. But the feeling I have now is of no specially different quality or intensity. No, I don't feel more religious because I'm dying. It's just a continuation of the general feeling of openness to the divine dimension that I've cultivated through having lived with my eyes open over the last 15 years. Like Kierkegaard, I would want to say that I've become religious not because I'm getting old and dying, but because, remember he was saying, well, if you know how old he was, I'm in my 30s when I'm writing this, so you won't think I'm writing it because I'm a frightened old man, something of that effect. And I would want to insist on the same thing. I think, and this is one very important aspect of my writings, or one point I would bring out that I think might easily be overlooked, and that is that if you take the growing up process of the child, which is essentially a masking over of his own fears and anxieties, right, with a secure cultural screen that protects him against the knowledge of his creatureliness, I think that's pretty secure. This is what character armor is. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting part of that whole business is that what the child does without knowing it is, since he feels powerless, and since he knows on some level of his personality that he's very, very vulnerable, he has to reinforce his sense of power. And he does this by plugging into a source of other power. Literally, almost, I like to look at it in electrical circuit terms. The father, the mother, or in some cases, the cultural system of ideas or ideology. This becomes his power source. And this is always unconscious. One doesn't know that what one's power source is. One doesn't know that he has given over the aegis of his life to this power source and that he himself is merely plugged into it. And I think the greatest deception of social life is that you talk about people who are centered. Well, there's no such thing. There's no center in people. People are not centered. People are utterly dependent on others for their feeling of strength. And you see it happen when somebody loses a father and they break down completely, or mother, feel helpless. And it's then that's revealed to them that in fact they weren't standing on their own feet. And we see people who occupy places, we think that man standing over there who's speaking is standing on his own feet, but he's not. He's speaking from delegated powers, which explains in the most direct way, of course, Stanley Milgram's work, you know, about the inability to disobey authority. Mm-hmm. Well, then one has no authority. So how can he disobey? People do not feel that they have the strength to disobey authority. This is the most striking thing about human beings. When it comes to crucial decisions, I mean, crucial moral and ethical decisions. On a day-to-day basis, you do make your own decisions, of course. If you're a cabinet maker, you decide what wood and so on to use, and you look like you're a person going through the world on your own. But in fact, and this is what comes out in therapy, isn't it, and personality breakdown, is that what is revealed to the person is that he's not his own person.
We're all possessed. Yeah. We're all possessed.
He's a construct. He's lying. The lie in his life is that he's tried to pretend that he was his own person.
Tell me about your self-analysis.
Well, this was a very big event in my life, lasting over a period of years. Supposedly something that can't be done, and yet, of course, all the early psychoanalysts, Freud and so on, claim to have done it. So I think it can be done, but it's very hard, and it's very accidental. It requires a certain concatenation of circumstances that are very, very unique. But I was in a period of my life where I was experiencing great anxiety. suddenly started to experience great anxieties. It was a transition period in my 30s, early 30s. And I wanted to find out why I was experiencing this anxiety. And I said to myself, what the heck is bothering me? And at that time, I was into psychoanalysis very, very deeply. I was reading about it. And I read a couple of very good books on dream analysis, Fromm's book, Forgotten Language, a few other very good things. I don't remember what they were at the time. And I thought that this would be a good time to try it myself. Except that, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you don't remember your dreams. So I took a night pad, like the one you have there, with a big thick pencil. And I decided, and I took it to bed every night. And then when I would wake in the middle of the night from a particularly striking dream, I would write out what the dream was in the dark, the scroll, but I could always read it the next day. And I would write out what feeling I had at certain points in the dream. And then I'd wake up in the morning and there would be the night pad with my dream on it. Sometimes, often I was very surprised that it was there. I forgot I'd gotten completely about the thing. In a half sleep, in other words, I had written down the dream and my reaction to it. And of course, as often happens with these things, your dream, in fact, gives you a salient message. I think that the unconscious, in that sense, and many people have said it, the unconscious tells you what's bothering you. And the unconscious wants to help you get over it. It's a very strange and yet real phenomenon. In other words, you get what are called message dreams. Dreams which tell you what is wrong and what is bothering you, which you can never, your ego will never tell you. Because the ego, of course, is a defensive mechanism. And I remember one very salient dream about a very vivid one. And I would spend the days after I had that dream trying to analyze it, trying to analyze the meaning of it. And it's amazing how easy it was to analyze it. Once I said, this happened in the dream, and then I said, well, I felt anxiety, great anxiety at this point. And I'd say, why did I feel great anxiety at that point? And I could almost not tell you this without telling you the dreams, which makes it, the dream which makes it very involved, and also highly personal. I don't know to what extent I want to get into it. But let me say that over a period of time, I found out what my characterological problem was, what was bothering me. I found out that what was bothering me was that I was living by delegated powers. I found out that my power sources were, in effect, not my own, and that they were, in fact, defunct. And I did this over a period of several years with a gradually increasing intensity of revelation about myself. And I think that if you talk about an analysis, what you're revealing to the person is his lack of independence, his conditioning, his fears, and what his power source is. And I found out that my power source was not what I thought it was. It wasn't in me. And this was just a shattering revelation to me. And I kept analyzing my dreams for years after that, and all I got was just more support for that idea. And so I had to consciously then find a way out of this dilemma. And it was at that point that I began exploring other dimensions of reality, like the theological dimension and so on. What it means when you have a tremendous anxiety attack. Well, that's something that that one can figure out, I think. If one goes through this kind of regimen, I don't know how. I asked Fritz Perls once, I said, do you believe it's possible for one to be self-analyzed? He said, no. And he said, well, maybe in very rare instances, it might be possible. And I think I was one of those rare instances where I was able to reveal to myself my dependence on powers that were not my own.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you're thrown back on yourself, well, what can you do except reach out then for other kinds of power? But then you do it in a very honest, open way, you see. You're not doing it in a reflexive way at all.
Yeah. Sure, are you?
This is the difference. I mean, I think this is the difference between fundamentalist evangelical religiosity, where you're reaching for other power is imprinted on you, more or less, and genuine religiosity, where you reach for God because there's nothing left for you. Like Peggy, someone like Peggy.
It just occurred to me. Do you know Bernanos' Diary of a Country Priest?
No, I don't know.
Oh, you would love that.
Yeah.
You would love that. I'll get it for you.
Really? Yeah. I'll read it. I'd like to.
It's about a person very much in your condition.
Yeah.
A country priest and his whole struggle with himself. It's one of those beautiful books. Just gorgeous. Gorgeous. I'll see that you get it.